Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling like a bro.
Oh, yeah?
An art bro.
Oh, an art bro.
An art bro. Yeah, and I'm feeling like my life is actually a rom-com. I've realised in researching today's guest that my life has just basically been a rom-com, but without the happy ending.
Without the romance.
without the funnies.
Sad.
It's very sad. But but the joy of the situation is that even if I didn't get a happy ending, today's guest did.
Sorry. Yeah.
In the rom-com I'm talking about,
Russell.
Oh, I see.
Right. Yeah.
I'm not doing like euphemisms already. Yeah, so today's guest wrote the most amazing rom-com. And in my eyes, I am very proud that he is joining us because to me, he is a pioneer and he is a visionary. And he is somebody who has done so much for LGBT rights just by being himself. Many of us, as myself included, first discovered him because of Billy on the Street. And I didn't see it in America, but I did see it on YouTube. And I remember being really captivated by his charisma and his wit and his just genuine enthusiasm for creativity. And it made me think of me and you, Russ, because we're bros, aren't we?
Big time.
And that, luckily, is the title of the current movie, which is out in cinemas now, even in the UK. Wonderful. I think it came out in September in America, but we finally got it in the UK cinemas, which is awesome. And we are going to be exploring his interactions and passion for art, which actually came to him through quite an unusual route. It's not necessarily something we've spoken much about before, but we are going to be exploring that, which is finding art through other creative mediums like film, theatre, musicals, things like that. And I know we've had previous guests like Pierce Brosnan, and we spoke about Thomas Crown Affair, which is one of my personal kind of highlights, where
the original art heist
movies. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And also Velvet Buzzsaw, which had our previous guest Zowie Ashton also on it. So today we are hopefully going to be educated about how art meets other industries. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art one of my heroes, Billy Eichner. Hi, Billy. Guys.
Hi, that was such a nice introduction. Thank you.
You deserve it, Billy. Where are you in the world?
I am in Los Angeles, California, like the Hollywood garbage that I am.
But you weren't raised in LA. You're a genuine New York raised Queens boy, right?
I am. Yeah, I'm a native New Yorker. I grew up in Queens, New York, one of the outer boroughs for those not familiar. But I went to high school in Manhattan. Not a private school, because everyone always thinks that when I say that, but it's what we would call now in America a magnet school. It was a very nerdy high school for math and science kids, which is weird because I wasn't really great at math and science, but I somehow got into this school. So I was a real city kid. I took the subway to high school every day, back and forth, an hour and 15 minutes each way, which was great. I loved it because it got me into the city. And I'm still in New York all the time, but I technically live in LA.
Why did you make the move to LA to become Hollywood garbage? Or just because?
It was actually because of Billy on the Street, because in the early seasons, you know, we didn't have much of a budget. It was being produced by a production company called Funny or Die, which you might have heard of. Mm-hmm. And I was always very, very hands-on in the editing of Billy on the Street. It's a huge part of it. I mean, it's a huge part of anything, especially in comedy, the editing. But for that show, it was just such a significant part of putting it together. And, you know, I knew I wanted to be hands-on in the editing. I work with amazing editors. I don't actually, you know, use the editing software. I'm not on the computer, but I'm right next to them. And it was cheaper for Funny or Die to put me up in LA for 3 months, where they already had production offices that we could use for free and have me edit there, than it was to keep offices open in New York, where we obviously shot the show, so that I could edit there. So I started to come out for a few months at a time. And then I started to get more work. I got a role on Parks and Recreation, and other things started popping up. And I ended up really liking it. I mean, it's such a change of pace from what I'm used to. As a native New Yorker, you know, especially growing up in the 80s and the 90s, we're all taught to reflexively hate LA, right? So, you know, I was taught to hate LA before I had ever stepped foot in LA. I just knew I hated LA, right? And then I started to come out here, usually for work purposes, and I was looking around like, wait a second. Have New Yorkers actually been here? Because it's really nice. And so I didn't mind it. And, you know, I still really love New York a lot. It's still so I was just there for a week, and I went to some galleries that Russell recommended, because I'm not really an art person. So I was hesitant to come on this podcast. But I still love New York. It's my favorite place. And I'm very much a New Yorker.
Well, before we get onto the art stuff, so Billy on the Street is this incredible show that you've fronted. I think there was 8 seasons, is that right?
It's a very strange trajectory. I started doing it in my live show. I had a live show in New York that I would do. And I started to develop this persona that was sort of like what Billy on the Street became, that, you know, sort of irrationally passionate about pop culture, right?
Yeah. Exactly. That's what we love about you.
Yeah. And so that persona I started to develop in a live show on stage in New York before YouTube even existed, because I am old. And I started doing those videos, and we would project them on a screen, you know, as part of my live show. And then YouTube came along. We did videos on YouTube, and then it became its own half hour series here in the States, which Funny or Die produced. We did 5 seasons of half hour episodes, but then we would take segments from the show and put them online. And that's really how people discovered it. And then after the show ended, we kept doing videos just for the internet and social media. And we did a bunch of videos with various celebrities. So it kept going even after the official TV show ended. And then it had a weird second and third life, because Netflix started showing the old episodes. And then on TikTok, it completely exploded, even though I didn't even have my own TikTok page. But fans were ripping the clips, you know, from the show or from online, wherever they were finding them. And it became insanely popular on TikTok. I think for kids who literally weren't alive when I started doing it, which is really weird. So it's had a crazy trajectory, Billy on the Street.
I think it also went really international as well, because I feel like I remember when it started popping up on Instagram all the time, and I found you very captivating and used to watch all the clips, and some of them are so funny and so brilliant. But
I'd put it out there with Carpool Karaoke in the way that just internationally sort of just blew up, and it became like a thing that we would see in our feeds on the daily. Would be whoever James was in the car with, and you, whatever celebrity you were with in New York, shouting at people.
Totally. Yeah, no, it definitely became a sort of social media phenomenon. Facebook at the beginning also was instrumental in, you know, getting the clips out there to an audience obviously beyond America. And I'm very grateful, you know. I mean, it's a crazy thing to do.
But the thing is that you did it. It's like incomparable ways, I'd say that us doing this podcast came from an absolute passion project, something we just made up, something we did, a platform for ourselves just to kind of be geeks and nerds. And Billy on the Street was something that you created as a platform for yourself to have this, you know, as you said, this irrational alter ego to let them free. And then it worked because it was genuine and it was fresh and it was meant.
Yeah, thank you. I went to a Northwestern and I was a theater major there. Northwestern is a, you know, very prestigious university here near Chicago with a very prestigious theater program. And, you know, we were like serious actors. And then I got to New York and started writing the live show, developed this persona, did these videos on a fluke. And for 3 years, we had Billy on the Street videos on YouTube that no one knew were there. Just they went undiscovered, right? And they were as funny as anything that I've ever done. But I don't know. That's just like the random nature of the internet. And then 3 years later, I kept doing them. One of them went viral, then another one went viral. Then Funny or Die reached out to me and, you know, it kind of took on a life from there. But I could have never in a million years predicted the popularity of it and that of all things would be my kind of entryway into a career. You know, you really never know.
You don't know who's watching at any moment or listening at any time.
But also your career has been so illustrious. And I was looking at your kind of IMDb, which I now know about because of Russell. I saw
his printed out on the wall.
Yeah, exactly.
He's with me now, actually.
He daily updates me on his IMDb credits. They're getting bigger by the week. But you've both been in American Horror Story, which is something that unites both of you. But you have worked with so many icons. I want to talk about some of them. So you've worked with Joan Rivers, RuPaul, you were in The Simpsons, Mariah Carey, who else? Beyonce.
Strangely enough,
it's pretty iconic. Who out of that lot? Actually, let's start with Joan Rivers, maybe, because that was near the beginning, wasn't it, of your career?
Yeah, Joan was really incredible to me. And I'm much closer with her, or was closer with her, obviously, than I am with some of the other, you know, very famous people that I've come into contact with, because she discovered me really early on before people knew who I was. She came to that live show I was doing in an off Broadway theater in New York.
Oh, wow.
This is around 2006. My first real TV job was a pilot for Bravo, and Joan Rivers had a pilot she was doing, and they wanted to do primetime version of the talk show The View, and which at the time was Barbara Walters sitting around with four different types of women and talking about the news of the day or pop culture or whatever. So they wanted to do a funny version of it with Joan Rivers sitting around with four different types of gay men talking about news and making jokes, right? And it was called Joan Rivers Straight Talk. Ha ha ha, LOL. So I auditioned for that, and she came to see me in my live show. No one knew who I was. And she just really got me on every level. And they put me in that pilot. Andy Cohen was also on the panel. This was before he had his own show.
No way. Oh, my God.
Yeah. This was summer of 2006, and it was me and Andy and Joan and two other gay men. There was like a conservative guy and like a very young publicist and me there to make jokes. And I think Andy kind of being Andy and Joan, right? And Joan and I became really close from that. And they didn't pick it up, but Joan just stayed like my biggest champion. And I mean, I could go on and on about like how supportive she was, you know, because at the time I was really struggling to get work. And I was in this very frustrating position where people would come to my live show or see my videos and say, oh, you're so funny, or you're this or you're that. But it wasn't translating into work. And she was just very encouraging. And she did this amazing thing where she started to do the talk show circuit again in New York and in LA. She did The Tonight Show and she did Jimmy Kimmel and all those shows. And she asked me to put my Billy on the Street videos that I had at the time on a DVD. And she said, she would drop them off with all the producers at the late night shows and tell them about me. And she did.
She did.
Right? And it was crazy. And then years later, my career took off. Billy on the Street became a TV show. And I ended up doing all those shows all the time. And I remember going to do Jimmy Kimmel for the first time as a guest. And the showrunner, the executive producer there at the time, saying to me, you know, it's amazing. A few years ago, Joan Rivers was here and she dropped off a DVD with your videos and said, you got to watch this guy.
Generous is that?
It was incredible. Now, Joan was a complicated person. Don't get me wrong. but she really was like unbelievably supportive. People used to think we were related, you know, like I was her grandson or something, because that was how much she championed me to other people. So she was just a blast to be around. She was so fun. She was the first celebrity that agreed to do Billy on the Street when it became a TV show, because I didn't know celebrities, you know. So she was really amazing.
Oh, well, rest in power, Joan. That's just phenomenal. And this was unaired, this pilot. Can we find this secretly somewhere on YouTube, or is it like disappeared?
I don't know. I don't think it's on YouTube. I think I have a DVD of it somewhere that they sent me. It wasn't very good, unfortunately. You know, it's just one of those things that didn't come together. But it's kind of interesting because Joan was in a bit of a career, you know, slump at the time. And then this pilot didn't get picked up. And then her career sort of took off again. She had this like late career resurgence about a year or two after this, where that documentary about her life, which is incredible. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. That came out, and I think it gave people a newfound respect for her. And then she ended up, sort of ironically, considering all the Trump stuff, like winning Celebrity Apprentice here. And she was very funny on that show. This is before Trump was a political figure. And so she had this resurgence afterwards. But at the time, people were a little iffy on her. And it was so much fun for me. You know, and there were many incredible moments with her.
Oh, I'd love to see it. Well, let's get on to the art side of your life then. So you've been quoted as saying, you said earlier on you don't know much about art, but you've been quoted as saying, the only art that speaks to me is fan art. Now,
I was joking.
Yeah, exactly. I don't believe that because, as Rob said, I did ask you to come on this, and your first impression was, I don't know much about art. I wouldn't know what to talk about. But then you said to me, but the art that I've learned about is through musical theatre. You said, I know about this Kandinsky through a play that I saw. You knew about a George Seurat painting through Sunday in the Park with George, which is a Sondheim musical. And it suddenly went ding, ding, ding. That is an incredible route to discover art through the theatre and through storytelling in another medium.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me be clear. You know, I'm not a total idiot. I mean, you know, one of the amazing things about growing up in New York City, and people always say to me, wow, that's so weird that you grew up in New York City. How was that? Was it strange? Obviously, it's all I knew. But one of the incredible things, and luckily I had, you know, parents who liked to take me, you know, from Queens into Manhattan and do cultural things. And when we were in school, they took us into the city to go to all these museums and things. So from a very young age, you're exposed to the Met and to the Museum of Natural History and to MoMA. And you might not grasp everything that you're seeing, but you know there's a world of art out there, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not like I had no exposure to it. I probably had way more exposure than most kids because of where I grew up. And also this is before the internet existed. So, you know, we didn't have that. As a tool to expose you to things. So I did go to a ton of museums as a kid, and these are some of the greatest, you know, museums in the world. It never spoke to me the same way that theater did or that movies did. But I was exposed to it, you know, so there's that. I mean, there was always, you know, I always liked things that were more like three-dimensional. You know, I liked collages. What are those?
Mobiles.
Mobiles, yes.
Yeah. The Calder mobiles, yeah.
Yes, exactly. So I remember that you always, as kids, they would always take you to see the Calder mobiles, right? Like when I was
kid friendly in some ways, you know, as a kid, that would be really, you'd get it, and this kinetic kind of energy going around.
Exactly. Like even today though, I like things that are more three dimensional. There's kind of and it's part of the reason I ended up liking Kandinsky beyond just hearing about him in a play, is because there's something like whimsical about it, right? It's like controlled whimsy, which is what they talk about in the play, 6 degrees of separation. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself.
No. Well, play, so did you see this when it was the movie, or did you see it on stage and you suddenly went, well, who's this Kandinsky then?
I saw 6 degrees of separation. I actually did not. My parents took me to see a ton of theater. I was really, really lucky. And we weren't rich people, but they loved theater too. So we kind of bonded over going to see plays. But for some reason, we never saw 6 degrees of separation, which was a big hit at Lincoln Center with Stocker Channing, I think in the late 80s, early 90s. Mm-hmm. But we skipped that one. I don't know why. Maybe they thought it was too adult or something. But they took me to see a ton of gay shit. I saw things that I shouldn't have seen as an 8-year-old. or maybe it's good that I saw them. Yeah. But we I don't know. We didn't see that one, but they played local commercials for it on local TV in New York. Like on a loop, they'd play commercials for 6 degrees of separation. And it's based on a true story, which I knew about the true story. Anyway, then they turned it into a movie with Stocker Channing and Donald Sutherland and Ian McKellen. And it's actually Will Smith's first film that he made after The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. And there's a famous story, which has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but it's interesting. And he's spoken about it, where he's playing a gay man, a gay or bisexual. I forget exactly how he identifies in the film. But he's playing a gay man, I believe. And there was a scene in the play where he makes out with another man on stage, right? And I think they're even naked together. And when they turned it into a film, and this is bizarre on a number of levels looking at it now, he said that he said yes to the movie, but only on the condition that he wouldn't be seen kissing another man on camera, because Bill Cosby had warned him that if he was on camera kissing another man, he wouldn't have a film career. And so they shot it in a way where you can tell he's kissing the guy, but it's from behind, so you don't actually see anything happening. By the way, I'm pretty sure Will Smith has been asked about this more recently and has said that if he wasn't willing to kiss a man on camera, he shouldn't have taken the role. Anyway, he's very, very good in Six Degrees of Separation. Everyone in it is spectacular. And I've always loved this movie. It's about many things. It touches upon race. It touches upon the class divide in New York City. And in the film, Stocker Channing's husband, played by Donald Sutherland, is an art dealer, right? And he's trying to sell this Kandinsky for $2 million, right? And they have it. They keep showing the Kandinsky, and it's a two-sided Kandinsky, right? And Stocker Channing's character keeps like flipping it around and saying, you know, chaos control. She keeps saying that, right? $2 million. She keeps repeating it. Anyway, as a kid, you know, I was a middle-class kid from Queens who really wanted to be a rich person in Manhattan, right? So I really romanticized the life that they're leading, even though it's about how they're all secretly terribly unhappy, you know. But that's how I was introduced to Kandinsky. I didn't know who Kandinsky was, and I didn't follow, you know, that art world as much as a kid. And so I would always tell anyone when they asked me, what painter do you like? I would say, oh, Kandinsky, right? but I knew about it from this film/play. But as it turned out, I did really end up loving Kandinsky, right? It wasn't just the play, you know? And I saw the Kandinsky show at the Guggenheim last fall. And I loved it. And so I actually do really love him. And I do think it's strangely because it is this sort of chaos control. Like, it's a combination. His work is like controlled whimsy. You know, it's very whimsical and colorful in a certain way, but it's also very structured.
Is that you?
Yes, because I was thinking about this. You know, I'm not comparing myself to Kandinsky, but just in terms of the qualities of his work that speak to me, I think a lot of what I do, whether it's Billy on the Street, even Bros has whimsical moments, right?
Yeah.
But it's all, like I was talking about, it's the editing is just as important as the chaotic part of it that we shoot on the street. So it's chaos edited down to something that may look raw and very freewheeling to you, because we're editing it to maintain that vibe, that aesthetic, but it's all done meticulously to capture that chaos, but it's edited down and it's framed in a certain way, right? Because if it was purely wild, you know, and you were just looking at raw footage of Billy on the Street, you wouldn't like it, right? It needs to be contained in some way. And there are whimsical touches in Bros too, but it's very contained within what I think is a pretty grounded story, right? But Bros, like most romantic comedies, is a mix of reality and fantasy, right? It's grounded, but it's also wishful thinking. That's all romantic comedies. That's every Nora Ephron movie,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, and I think there is something to that quality of chaos and control,
yes,
that I'm drawn to.
Well, I think you are quite chaotic in the performances, what you do, Billy on the Street especially, but then the control comes from the edit. So you know you can be as chaotic as you want, you're wild then, but when you get back into that dark room, you can, you know, contain it all and make it how you want it to be.
And it's chaos, but there's a point to it, right? Like, the best of Billy on the Street, sometimes it's just silly and fun. But the best of what we did had a real satirical level to it, right? Like, we were the whole persona was built to satirize my own obsession with the entertainment industry from a young kid, right? It's satirizing, it's poking fun at it, and also celebrating it, you know, this kind of irrational interest in entertainment, you know? And so there's... it is grounded in that idea, even though it feels very raw and free. You know, a lot of thought went into it. You know, yes, it's improvised once I get on the street, but the questions I'm asking people, again, the way it's edited down, a lot of thought goes into it. I did a series here called Difficult People on Hulu, which also had some really absurdist, whimsical touches, but was really grounded in the reality of being, you know, a struggling actor, writer in New York, but with whimsical touches, right? And absurdist touches. Like, I've always liked whatever that genre is, I've always loved it. It's Annie Hall, you know, it's Woody Allen and Diane Keaton and Annie Hall. On one level, it's a very grounded, sad, real feeling love story between two ultimately mismatched people, but there are all these absurdist, whimsical moments in it, right?
I saw one of the interviews that you did on your kind of press tour. I think it was like some sort of global tour you did for many months promoting Bros, the movie. Yeah. And one of the British interviewers said to you, you know, when you were doing Billy on the Street, would you ever have looked forward and realized that you might one day be the leading man and co-writing, you know, a major blockbuster movie, which is kind of what previously you would have been a fan of, even though that genre of Bros is in many ways groundbreaking and a new genre in many ways. But what was that like to suddenly, you know, have this opportunity to make a motion picture, and also with Judd Apatow, because I feel like what you're talking about, that genre, is very like specific to him as well, because I know that he was involved. I know he didn't write it, but he's very much come from that really
he's
fascinating...
He's the zeitgeist for that, isn't he?
Yeah,
ways.
And he kind of champions such fascinating people, not just yourself, but also our mutual friend Lena Dunham. Russ and I are friends with her, and yeah. You know, if you think of the support he gave her at a very early stage, I feel like he spots kind of quite unique characters and really gives them agency and helps them to grow.
He does, and I really admire that about him. I think Judd obviously cut his teeth and had a lot of success telling stories that very much in the earlier part of his career centered on his own existence, you know, as a straight man, you know, looking for love and, you know, sort of navigating the world of sex and dating and relationships with straight women. And I think he did a really admirable thing, which is to take whatever capital he built from that and all the massive success he had, and then allowing other people that were not sort of, you know, Judd Apatow prototypes to take center stage and tell their version of that story. Lena Dunham is a perfect example. He did it with Amy Schumer. He produced Bridesmaids, which at the time, you know, wasn't that long ago, but there were legitimate debates when that movie came out about whether you could have a major comedy starring only women, right? There were, I mean, it's bizarre to think about now, but it wasn't that long ago. I remember, quote unquote, legitimate debates happening on Twitter about whether women were funny enough to carry a movie. I mean, I know it sounds insane, but these were going on, these types of conversations, not that long ago. And then he did it again, you know, he did it with Kumail Nanjiani with The Big Sick. And then he did it again with me and Bros. And I'm really grateful for that opportunity. And he also understands his place in that, especially with a story about gay men, which he really is. He's very much not a gay man. He doesn't live in our world. And he doesn't claim to. So he guides you along, you know, as did Nick Stoller, who I wrote it with and who directed the movie. They're straight men living pretty what we would call heteronormative lives. but they are very aware of that. And they always encouraged me to tell the most honest story possible, as long as it was funny. You know, and you do want it to be relatable. I mean, you want it. You want people, no matter what their sexual orientation is, to be able to feel what's happening in the movie and to be entertained by it, right? The way that we've been entertained by rom-coms about straight people for decades.
Sure.
But they really let me guide the movie creatively because I'm writing about my life and my world. And they let you do that without getting in the way. And I appreciate that too.
But I really love the fact that film exists now. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you, even if you think about that comment about Will Smith, you know, the film industry that he was entering at that point, you know, in that space of 25 years or whatever it might have been, it's like, I just love that Bros exists and that the lead actors are gay. You know what I mean?
Like, everybody's you're playing gay, but you are actually gay.
Like, that's really important too.
But also what Billy did was that everybody who was playing straight were queer. So he was subverting Hollywood's traditions with casting, which is it's incredibly groundbreaking beyond.
Yeah, I mean, thank you. Yeah, it was challenging, you know, the whole thing's challenging. It was just there isn't much of a blueprint for Bros, you know.
You are the blueprint.
And when I say that, people get mad when I say that. But what about decades of queer indie films? Yes. Of course. Like, I grew up on those movies. Like, I'm older than all of you motherfuckers. And like, I saw those movies in the movie theater. Okay. I had very weirdly liberal, supportive parents in New York City growing up in the 80s. Right. And I watched My Beautiful Laundrette with my father that I rented to watch on a VCR, you know, and I watched My Own Private Idaho. And my parents took me to see Truth or Dare in the movie theater the weekend it opened, you know, like, no one needs to tell me about the history of indie queer films because I saw them all. But it's just a different Bros, you know, was released in 3,000 movie theaters in North America, you know, the way that a Judd Apatow movie would normally get released.
Exactly.
You know, and that is very new, right? So for a movie that queer with all of these queer actors, you know, that part of the experience was very new, and there isn't much of a blueprint for that. And so it was all very challenging and wonderful. And I've gotten so many messages, not exclusively from queer men, but mostly from queer men all over the world, you know, talking about how much the movie meant to them in ways that surprise me, you know, and make me very emotional. Because, you know, gay guys can be really snarky. It's just kind of part of our makeup for whatever reason. There are reasons for that, but I won't go into that.
Did your family know that you were gay growing up? Because Truth or Dare is the Madonna movie. And is it true that you had a Madonna-themed bar mitzvah?
This has been... Well, I mean, I didn't come out to my parents until I was in college. I think I was 20. But did they know? I mean, how could you not know when
you're you have
like,
a poster
you know,
of John Bon Jovi on your wall as well?
I did. I had a poster of Madonna, which may have thrown them because she was like sort of topless in it. But I was like, come on, that's not why I have the poster of Madonna up on my wall. And then I was obsessed with John Bon Jovi and Bon Jovi as a kid. And I had a poster of John Bon Jovi on my wall too. My cat's name was Jovi. I really loved Bon Jovi.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah.
Rob had the sex book when he was at senior school, and he took it around the school with him. And he also convinced a lot of his other student friends that he was the son of Madonna.
I did. I said I was called Troy Boy. When I was about 12 years old, I'd already seen Truth or Dare as well. I had the sex book.
I did too. I did too.
And I told everyone I was called Troy Boy. I didn't actually say I was Madonna's son. I said I was called Troy Boy and that's what everyone had to call me. And then some kid in my class told everyone that I was Madonna's son and they believed me. And it went on for about 3 weeks where people kept walking up to me.
And you're walking around with your mum's book with her like completely naked.
I had the sex book too. My mom, I was such a Madonna fan. My mom went and stood online the day the sex book came out and bought it for me.
For her son. For her 12-year-old son.
How old was I? Yeah, I was like 13. Yeah.
What year were you born? I'm 1980. So.
Oh, I'm 1978.
Exactly, so it's similar, yeah. So you were probably like 13, 14, I was probably like 12.
12 with this, it's so graphic.
I don't think I got the book from my mum though, I can't remember where I got it from.
You said your dad got it for you.
Oh no, I think my brother, or maybe my dad got it for me, or my brother, I can't remember, I think my brother might
actually, the sex book is actually probably the first art book I ever had, now that I think about it.
And it's just been reissued in Art Basel, Miami.
Yes, but it's an exhibition, isn't it?
Yeah.
Who's the photographer of his name?
Stephen Meisel.
Stephen Meisel. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Some of it is so beautiful. So
those prints look
well.
Beautiful. Like some of them I'd actually want. They're stunning.
Yeah. And Naomi Campbell's in the book and like loads of her friends and like kind of cool
people. So's Vanilla Ice. And so's
Vanilla
Ice. She always liked us super. I mean, Vanilla Ice was hot. He was like a very good looking guy.
Oh,
like,
yeah, but also John Bon Jovi was too. I meant to say that a minute ago. John Bon Jovi had a point where he was so hot. I remember that too.
Of course. He was so hot, John Bon Jovi.
No, but in the 80s, I wasn't thinking about John Bon Jovi, but I remember when it may be like late 90s or mid 90s, he was so hot. Anyway,
very good looking.
Very good looking. Right.
John.
I want to get back to. just a 6 degrees separation. So for people listening, if you go on YouTube and you type 6 degrees of separation Kandinsky, there is a scene that contains Donald Sutherland and Stockard Channing and a very charming Ian McKellen, who looks incredible. And Will Smith comes in and they see this Kandinsky painting, which is double-sided. But the reality is that there is no double-sided Kandinsky painting that exists. There are two paintings that exist in the world. One of them is called Black Lines from 1913, and the other one's called Several Circles from 1928. And they are both in the Guggenheim collection. So that is an amazing thing that you've introduced our listeners to now, and myself and Robert. But then the other one I wanted to talk about was Sondheim. So Sondheim's a big deal for you, and you two both share a favorite swear word, a favorite curse word I read online.
Oh, fuck, right?
Yeah, so yeah. Sondheim loved the word
it's
fuck.
It's a popular one.
Yeah.
I thought you meant me, Russ. I was like, hang on, there's quite a few. I like lots of swear words. How am I going to pick?
Nasty. Okay. So Stephen Sondheim musical, which is Sunday in the Park with George. So did you see this as a stage show and then discover George Surratt, the artist?
I didn't see it on Broadway, the original. I was a little too young. I think Sunday in the Park with George premiered on Broadway in 1984. I was 6 years old. I wasn't going to Broadway shows just yet. But I remember seeing it on the Tony Awards and seeing ads for it. And then PBS, the public broadcasting station here, they recorded the original Broadway production. And they showed it on TV. And I think it's still on YouTube. Right. And I highly recommend it. It's with Mandy Patinkin and Bernadette Peters. If you like musical theater or like elevated, smart musical theater, it doesn't get better than that. And so that's how I discovered it on TV. And then, you know, I discovered songs from the show by buying CDs and all that, you know, type of thing. And then as I got older, they revived the show. I saw it on Broadway. They have revived it a few times on Broadway. They did it a couple of years ago. They did it again with Jake Gyllenhaal.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's
I
like
saw
a benefit
that
one, wasn't it? Like a few nights.
Yeah, but yes, but then they brought it to Broadway for a longer run. It was him and Annalee Ashford, actually. And they were both fantastic. I mean, it's just, especially if you do anything creative with your life or try to, it's just, I don't think there's a better piece of art written about what it's like to be an artist. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's just brilliant. I can't do it justice right now. But James Lapine, the original director of the original production, and he also, I believe, wrote the book with Sondheim. He put out a book of his own a couple of years ago, which I just bought and I'm in the middle of reading, about the making of Sunday in the Park with George, starting from the very early days of him and Sondheim meeting and figuring out they wanted to do a musical together, but he wasn't sure about what. And his first visit to the Art Institute of Chicago, where he saw the painting and he does all these interviews. He did a lot of interviews with Sondheim before Sondheim died about it, and with all the original artists and designers who worked on it, all the original actors. It's incredible.
Wow.
He kept everything. He has like photos of like notes and Sondheim like, you know, scribbling ideas and, you know,
so cool.
It's incredible. And so I'm reading that now because I've always loved the musical so much. So it's rare that you get to go so in depth about a musical, you know, the way this book allows you to do, which is pretty awesome.
Well, Sondheim was a very big letter writer. There's a whole thing, feed on Instagram you can follow.
Yeah.
I have to look it up in a second, but it's basically all the letters that Sondheim has ever...
I think it's called Sondheim Letters.
Is it? Yeah.
I mean,
I follow that. It's so nice. Like every other day when I come up and he's a whimsy guy, the way that he writes about the world, the way he responds to people and connects to an audience that are, you know, wanting more information from him and his attentions. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. But yeah, so that musical is about George Surratt and about him creating the canvas titled Sunday Afternoon on the Island of La Grande Jatte, I think is how you say it, which is amazing. But it got me thinking again about other shows that have starred, you know, artists, that have been about artists. Mm-hmm. There's a show called Red, which was about Mark Rothko, which is a John Logan play, which is a study of him making this series of paintings that were for the Seagram murals, which were at the Four Seasons Hotel And this was a series of paintings, and it was his first commercial venture. He didn't believe in commercialization of art. He just believed in making it. But it's about him making this suite of paintings that I think were eventually turned down by the hotel. They didn't want them. And he said he made them that he hoped to ruin the appetite of whatever son of a bitch, whoever eats in that room, was why he made them. So I think eventually they got back to the hotel and they turned it down. But this was an incredible play. Alfred Molina played Rothko, and then Eddie Redmayne was playing his assistant. So that was phenomenal. And then we've also got Art, which hasn't been on, it hasn't been revived for ages, but Yasmina Reza. I don't know if you ever
saw that. I did, but it was so long ago.
Right. It needs to come back. I think you should be in that. That for me feels like I would love to do that with you. And I've always thought about that play because I feel like,
wow,
it would be so brilliant to bring back, you know, for me personally, because I'm obsessive art, and it's about these three friends, and one of them purchases a pure white canvas and then brings it back. And it's everyone's opinion, like, what the hell is this shit? How much money did you spend on that? What does it make you feel? And it's this whole kind of discourse on the conversations and the words that we use to talk about art. And then it opens up wider themes about, you know, love and honesty and trust and authenticity. And it's an incredible play, and it's been translated.
I have to reread it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Let's do it. I
was just talking to my theater agent about finding a play to do in New York, and I couldn't figure it out. So you might have solved that problem. But I saw it on Broadway. I remember, I think it was Victor Garber and Alan Alda, maybe. I think it was a huge hit. I mean, Art was a huge hit. I mean, it's a rare play on Broadway that made a lot of money. And I'm guessing it won the Tony for best play, although I can't quite remember. I remember I saw it, but I can't really. And I remember being very entertained by it. It's very entertaining.
It is.
But I don't really remember it.
Yeah, I think what people was assuming that they were going to go as an audience and come away going like, ha ha ha, isn't art shit? Ha ha ha, aren't we having the wall thrown over our eyes? But it became really poignant and emotional, and people really connected to this pure white canvas. And here originally it was Ralph Fiennes, Ken Stott, and Tom Courtney that did it on the West End.
I was going to say, because they did it in the West End. I saw it in the West End.
Yeah, that's
all coming back to me now.
Yeah. Saw it. You did see
it. Yes, I saw that version of it. Right. What year was that? It's a long time ago, though.
It was like 1964, I think.
Oh,
it was.
Oh, fuck off, Russell.
No, I know. It must have been in the 90s, early 90s.
It was like mid 90s, I think.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was really it was a big hit on Broadway. It was a big hit on Broadway.
Oh my god, it's going to be a big hit again.
We're going to bring it back.
Feel it. Then I'm going to buy all the tickets. It's just going to be me sat in the audience.
Oh god, awful. There's hundreds because I did like a Google deep dive on this, and there's another book called Vincent in Brixton, which is a play by Nicholas Wright. Which at 16 years old, Vincent came to Brixton because he was working with his father and his uncle in the art industry. In the art dealing industry. And then there was a department, it's called Goupil and Co. And there was a department that was in London. So he moved to London, to Brixton, to South London for 2 years. And I think there's a plaque somewhere where he lived. And there's a whole play about that. So there's been lots and lots of shows that have centered artist movements, artists, you know, narratives as the main protagonists.
I wonder if those films as well, because they had like that Turner film, didn't they, a few years ago?
It did.
And then
there's a film
about Pollock, and then Bowie played Warhol movie.
That's right.
And then there's obviously the Downtown 81, but that's actually, I think that was actually
more docu style, wasn't
it? More a docu style thing. Yeah. I'm not sure if there was a story.
I'm surprised there hasn't been a Warhol musical.
Musical or something.
Do you know what I mean? It would make.
There's a play right now about Warhol and Basquiat.
That's right. That came from the Young Vic.
It just started in New York. Yes. I haven't seen it, but I think they're in previews right now or something. Yes. And I loved the Andy Warhol Diaries. I thought that was fantastic. God.
Wasn't it incredible?
Incredible. It was so good. Incredible.
Yeah, it was like crack. I felt like crack watching every episode.
It was. I know. I could have watched... That, to me, was like Lord of the Rings. I mean, I could have watched it for like 12 hours at a time.
I'm with you there.
It was
that
so...
Was that was Ryan Murphy, wasn't it? Ryan did that.
5 years that took to make.
It was really beautifully done. It was so moving, and so many things that as much as we've all heard about Warhol, and when I started watching it, I was like, all right, more about Andy Warhol. Like, we get it. Campbell's soup cans. We know the factory. But I was so wrong. And there was so much that we were never told. And also hearing about, you think Andy Warhol, he was so queer, and whether he was out or not, even it almost didn't matter because it was so overt. It was so obvious in his aesthetic, you know, and yet his own internal struggles about that and wanting to be mainstream, even though he was so downtown and subversive. It was really fascinating.
It was.
Yeah, totally.
Totally. So when I asked you to come on as well, you said in the intro that I gave you some prompts to go and see some exhibitions. I recommended a few to you.
And I went.
I love that about you. I absolutely love that about you. So what
you're the first person that's ever done what
has ever listened to me.
maybe this play will actually happen.
What did you see? What did you respond to? Can you remember what I was recommending was good to go?
I went to the MoMA and I saw Wolfgang Tillmann.
Yeah.
Is that it?
Tillmann's, yeah.
Tillmann's,
yeah. Which I enjoyed. You know, it covered a lot of ground that I grew up with. So, you know, it's very, you know, the queer 1990s, you know, experience. Not all of it, but a lot of it was about that. And it was, you know, Pride, the 1992 Pride Parade and the Love Parade and a lot about the AIDS epidemic and, you know, the politics around it. And all of that stuff is very fascinating to me, but it's stuff that I've read about and seen a lot of, you know, films and read a lot of books about already. So I enjoyed it. It wasn't like revelatory to me only because of the very few things in life that I know anything about. That era is probably one of them. Right. Wow. And I grew up with it. So that makes sense. But there was a Barbara Kruger installation there that I really loved. I don't remember the name of it. But again, it's very, you know, it's almost theatrical, her work. Right. Mm. And it's very immersive. You know, it almost felt like you were on the set of a play, like it could have been the background of a play, you know, and that always speaks to me. And I'm a writer and it was all words, you know, it was all just like very big letters and words, you know, going from like, you know, the floor to the ceiling of the MoMA. So very, very much like larger than life and very theatrical and very sort of word focused, which is, I'm a writer. I'm a very like verbal person. So
do you think you find yourself attracted to artists that use text then? Like Jenny Holzer, for example, is someone similar, like Protect Me From What I Want. And
Ed Ruscha.
Yeah, Ed Ruscha and Glenn Ligon.
I don't know any of those people because, again, I'm an idiot when it comes to art, fine art. But I probably would be, yes. I mean, again, I'm a very verbal person. And so I guess I'm drawn to what I myself like and who I am in a way. Though I try to challenge myself with other things, but ultimately, you know, you are who you are.
Was it nice being in the MoMA? Did it feel busy in there? Or
it was, you know, leading up to Christmas week, so New York is pretty is buzzing. And it was, and I'm so glad that I asked you for recommendations because it was interesting. And then I went to some of the galleries in Chelsea. And, you know, this is amazing because I grew up in New York City, you know, and I'm like a real city kid. But that fine art world, that world of galleries, I know it's there. I probably walked by a million times. But again, I was never part of it. I was never that drawn to it for some reason. So I spent a very rainy afternoon in New York City, you know, walking in and out of those galleries in Chelsea. And some of it speaks to you more than other things, but it was lovely. You know, it was very zen. And it's cool to find a new thing to do in New York when I've been there my entire life. And it's like a window. I'm an artist of sorts, you know. I obviously like love the performing arts and I do it professionally. So it's weird because there is this sort of loose connection between the two worlds and that they're all very creative, but they're also very separate, right? And I saw so much theater in New York when I was there too last week. But theater, which is like the thing I love I don't do it professionally, but it's the thing I love most. And
we will be doing it professionally.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. We're mounting art. Yes. But it's the thing that I love most. But then you go to these galleries and I was like, oh, this is a whole new level of pretentiousness, which I could really get into. I mean, the theater world almost seems so pedestrian and accessible by in comparison.
I can see this for you, Billy. You're going to be like a collector of sculpture because you'll have a calendar in a few 3D years. Artworks. I can imagine that you're going to have like a sculpture park, the Billy
sculpture park.
And you can wear like fancy outfits, bright colors, flowing.
But it was fantastic, and I'm so glad I did that.
I think the thing with art is why you see a kind of connection is the fact that it is storytelling. It's just a different medium, and it's a medium that we're not brought up with. We're brought up with film and music and books, and we have the ability to critique them and understand them and compare them. But when you're not shown art, you have no ability to critique it, so it doesn't belong to you. But all it is storytelling in a different way. Art is made because people haven't got the words enough to speak, so art speaks for them.
And I actually shouldn't say that in certain ways theater seems more accessible, but really theater is so expensive, and these galleries and museums are free to very, or at least, you know, not nearly as expensive as a theater ticket, and you can spend all day in there. So it's interesting because the image that's been cultivated around it, it almost feels like there's a barrier, like it's not for everyone, or that you do need to be a very wealthy person. But that's actually not true. But it's weird because the optics of it don't feel as accessible as it actually is, even to me, because I grew up in New York, you know, with access to these things.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that it's kind of designed in that way?
I don't know. Maybe the people who actually buy art, who could afford it, maybe they like that part of the culture because there's an elitism to it.
And there's a value system that gets attributed to that as well, like out of something being special.
Yes, but
it can then be very, very valuable.
But there's always been museums, and there's always been public art, and it's always been said it's for us, and they make it free, and they promote it, and they want everybody of every creed to go in there. So why does it still feel inaccessible to so many, or not welcoming?
Fine art needs a better publicist.
Well, I feel like we've been trying.
Yes. Yes. But also this, you know, art requires the viewer, I think, that type of art, to do a little more work. You know, you can't you could sort of lazily walk around a gallery, and that's actually a very pleasant thing to do. But to really try to understand what the artist is going for, what the artist is about, whatever part of the human condition that he's trying to capture, you've got to stand there and you've got to take it in, and it requires some work, you know, some mental work of your own. It's not like a movie or even a play, which is being acted out at you, right?
Yes.
You can let it wash over you or something.
Yes,
like
exactly.
From your seat. Yeah. One of the really nice things I think about New York that's quite special is you can go with your friends and just go and see 5 or 6 shows all in one street or whatever, or in one district. Like Russell and I have done it a lot. And often, like, I leave completely interested in what I've just seen. But then occasionally you get that one show that strikes a chord with you. And it's a bit like when you go and see 5 movies, you might enjoy 3 of them, but 2 of them might really change your life, or one of them might, you know, really speak to you. And I think that's why it's a really good thing to get into a habit of doing with your friends. It's like maybe once a month or once every 3 months, you know, you go on an art thing, because you might discover something that takes you to somewhere you never thought you might go.
Oh yeah, absolutely. No, it made, even though not everything I saw spoke to me necessarily, some of it did, it made me want to do it more.
Yes.
You know, like it's a, you've accomplished what you wanted to here at Talk Art. It did. And like I said, it's kind of like a cool new world to enter into.
Yeah, and a whole new opportunity to be pretentious, which we love.
Yes, exactly.
The Barbara Kruger work, which is running until early January 2023 at MoMA, is called Thinking of You, which is then crossed out. I mean me, crossed out. I mean you.
Yes.
Yeah, and then the word you is repeated quite a few times, but there's an amazing line in it that says, you are seeing and being seen, which I thought kind of speaks to, you know, all kinds of creativity,
voyeurism.
Theater and voyeurism. And I don't know, it's very much about art, I guess.
I love it. Well, before we get on to our final questions, I just want to talk about one episode of Billy on the Street, which I did find, which maybe this is one of the ones that has disappeared and needs to be rediscovered, in 2014, where it's called Just Like Tyler Perry, I Hate Art. And you are going through and asking people their facts, Tyler Perry facts, and if they get it right, you destroy a piece of art. We have a Mondrian that's torn up, a Warhol that's smashed over a a water event thing. There's a Ming vase you drop on the floor.
That's very Ai Weiwei.
It is very Ai Weiwei. Is that, does Tyler Perry hate art? I was trying to find where that, is that a real quote, or are you just like, was it being generalized then?
Yes, I was being an asshole. I was being pretentious. Yes,
I'm researching you, and I go Billy Eichner art, and he goes just like Tyler Perry, I hate art, and then you're smashing everything. I was like, uh oh.
Well, it was. I mean, I actually, like I said, I'm not a big fine art person, right? And I'm not a person who like runs to museums all the time. But I think at the time, Tyler Perry was very much in the zeitgeist, you know, and he kind of defines a type of artist in a way whose work is extremely commercial and accessible while often being kind of like frowned upon by, you know, people who consider themselves like higher creative authorities and critics and film critics and things like that. Right. And so I think I was kind of satirizing all of that. Because what we did on Billy on the Street is sort of take whatever everyone's cultural obsessions were at that time and comment on them. And I think that's what that was. I totally forgot about that.
It's a segment. Brilliant episode.
It is. It's pretty funny though. I have
the end stranger on the street is a great button. The what he says to you at the end. So I'll let people discover that.
Yeah, I don't even remember. I'm gonna have to go back.
I think he just swore at you. I think it's what most people do eventually. Yeah, exactly. On every episode they do.
Yeah.
So we have three questions that we ask every guest at the end. The first one is: if you could do an art heist, if you could have any work of art for yourself, as you're now a newfound collector, what artwork would you have in the world and why?
Oh God, I guess probably a Kandinsky.
Nice.
Or maybe one of those Calder mobiles. Really create a full circle moment.
Maybe we could get you the Kandinsky prop Kandinsky, the double-sided, which only exists in the movie.
Right.
And you can turn it around and go, chaos control.
Yes, exactly.
Whatever mood you're in.
I like doing a lot of Stalker Channing cosplay at home. Yes,
exactly.
Who doesn't?
Yes.
Breakfast and dinner and everything.
Guys love that. Guys love that. When I find
that hot. Guys find that hot. That is hot.
It is so hot. Yeah,
that YouTube clip is like really regularly watched. I think you need a tiny Calder mobile because there's some that are like really tiny and you can like sit in your hand. I love those ones.
Oh, that's cute.
They sometimes come up at auction. And I went to, actually, I think you came with me, Russ. We went to the house of
the foundation,
the grandson of Calder, together in New York. And we've actually met both of the grandsons, I think.
He had one on
Holton
the table
Rauer,
next to
and Sandy Rauer.
That's right. And he had one next to a meteorite, a genuine meteorite, huge one.
That's right.
And it was positioned next to that. It's quite
To like a small, he had loads of small ones.
Yeah.
Anyway,
he did.
Love it. The other question we ask every guest is, what is your favorite color?
I like black.
Do you? Right. Okay.
I'm a New Yorker. You know, we wear a lot of black. It's kind of true. No, that's a cliche. I do like black. I also like, I just bought an apartment in LA, which I'm decorating, and it's a very like kind
black.
Of,
you're painting it all black, are you?
Yes, it's a black box theater, actually. I live in a black box theater. No, there are a lot of like, it's a lot of like champagne. I like that. Kind of nice. Like a. It's kind of like an earthy,
warm,
but earthy but elevated.
I love that.
Talk about
we,
pretentious.
We also love,
I mean,
we love champagne.
That's not pretentious. Doesn't? That is that warm kind of autumnal shades.
I like a warm tone. Yes,
me too.
Chaos Talking about control. Your house, do you actually live with anything in your house like art? Did you have any like posters or postcards or
Madonna?
Do you surround yourself with
John Bon Jovi?
Yeah,
still.
Obviously.
You know, it's interesting you bring this up because I've been decorating this place now, and I pretty much have all the furniture, and my walls are bare.
Wow!
And I have to figure out what to put on my walls, which has
always
been tough for me. Yeah, I don't know.
We will help you. That'd be an absolute pleasure.
We're going to help you.
Tell us your budget. Tell us what you're into, and we can.
I don't even know. I don't even know.
It's endless. Honestly, you've given Russ the challenge now. He loves this kind of stuff.
It's mostly just my headshot blown up and framed everywhere
in an Andy Warhol style.
The black and just white
Google images, yeah. Just printed off, laminated.
What's the best advice you've ever received
when it comes to your work?
Sorry, I'm thinking.
We can hear your brain.
I don't know if anyone told me this or it's something I just kind of figured out, although I have read other people who say a version of this, and it's nothing too radical or revolutionary, but it is always something to keep in mind, especially about show business. Nobody knows a goddamn thing. Mm-hmm. Like, no one knows what's going to be successful. Everyone knows after the fact and then acts like they're an expert in hindsight. But no one knows anything, you know, so about what's going to hit or what's not going to hit or what the best road is for you to go down creatively as a writer, as an actor. You really have to do what makes you happy and just listen to your gut. That doesn't mean you don't listen to people's advice if you trust them, obviously. But anyone who tries to tell you that they know exactly how something is going to go or tells you anything definitive, it's bullshit. Don't listen to them.
I love that advice.
So do I.
That's fantastic. You are.
It's scary advice. It's scary advice.
Scary, yeah.
Because that means there's no rules to anything. And like everyone wants to find a formula or a pattern, but there literally is not one, right? And so I don't know. It's liberating and it's terrifying at the same time.
You've made your own pattern. Bros is the new pattern, the new blueprint. You've put something out there which wasn't there before that now feels like it's been there forever and will change lives.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah, and I think it's going to keep growing and growing, that film. I think it's like, it's a kind of thing that like once it's streaming, I think it's going to reach so many more different people as well.
Every
like
new generation, every queer kid is going to end up watching
like really
it.
Talking about it a lot in the UK as well. Like it's become a kind of word of mouth thing. I know a lot of people who have loved it and tell their friends, and it's like a domino effect. And I don't think I think it's one of those things that's just going to, it'll have its own life and it's going to change a lot of people's lives.
Thank you.
You know, it made
sweet.
Me think that comment you made at the end then, it made me think about Self-Esteem, the singer who was a guest on our show recently. And she was saying that the more I had dinner with her recently for the Spogue dinner in London, it was really fancy. But she said, like, the more successful you get, you sort of get into these offices of like very important people. And then they're just asking you what to do. And she's like, don't you know what the answer is? And like, no one has the fucking answer. And she's like, the bigger she's getting, she realizes that everyone wants her just to come up with what, you know, it's just funny that actually a lot of people are just blagging it as well.
There's also something that we deal with in our business a lot and in our world a lot, where this whole thing that you should stay in your lane.
Yes.
Right. And that's something that, especially if you're a gay man, especially if you're a gay actor, maybe if you're just a gay person in life in general, culture, society, certainly the entertainment industry has, at least up until very recently, seen you in a very particular way.
Totally. Yeah.
Right? And if anything, they're telling you, you're lucky that we see you at all. So just stay and keep doing that one thing, because that's all anyone's going to want from you. That's all we believe you can do, et cetera, et cetera. And you have to work really hard to actively fight against that. And you have to force people like that, which is most people, to change the wiring in their brain, right? About how they perceive you, how they perceive gay people, how they perceive anyone, really, right? Because we all have this sort of impulse to really stereotype people and just sort of, okay, you do that one thing, that's what he does, that's all he does, great. And you have to work really hard, you know, don't just sit. Part of being an artist is like forcing yourself to evolve. And I think you have to work really hard to do that. Don't let them keep telling you can only do one thing, you know, like, and if they do, just be like, fuck you, I'm not doing it. I'm going to go make this other thing. That's important too, I think.
Lovely.
Thank you, Billy. You're brilliant.
Great way to close the episode.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, for everyone listening, go to our Talk Art on Instagram and we will be posting images of everything we discussed today. Go on YouTube and check out Billy on the Street and watch that scene in 6 Degrees of Separation, comma, Kandinsky. Book tickets now for Yasmina Reza's Remounting of Art, which will be starring myself and Billy
Rob hasn't bought all the tickets
first. Rob hasn't bought all the tickets
first. And also, you can see Billy's Instagram, which is at Billy Eichner. And Billy, you've just got the green light for a new film, no? Aren't you starting to write another film?
We're starting to write it. We don't have the green light for it yet. But
you have got the green light. If you say you've got the green light.
That's true. I should just bullshit and say that we have it.
We are giving you the green light.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm working on a new movie for Amazon called Ex-Husbands. It's about a big gay divorce. If you know the movie The War of the Roses from the 80s, it's like a gay version of that. It's not a remake of The War of the Roses, but that's sort of the vibe.
Yeah.
The genre.
Yeah, War of the Roses was very much a statement on 80s materialism, and that's not what we're doing at all, because ours takes place now. But the idea that there's this big gay divorce comedy, dramedy or something like that, I was interested in that. So I think, and I'm writing it with Paul Rudnick, who's a gay screenwriter who wrote so many movies that a lot of us grew up with. He wrote Sister Act and Adam's Family Values and In and Out. He wrote the play and movie Jeffrey, which in the 90s was like a very big thing. He's fantastic, and so I grew up loving his work, so the fact that I get to work with him is really cool.
It's an iconic title as well. I'm already excited to see it, so you better get the green light.
Yeah, it's called Ex-Husbands. Yeah.
And it's brilliant. Fantastic.
Yeah. Well, thanks
well,
a lot,
we'll
Billy.
Be back very soon.
Thank you. And thanks for encouraging me to go see some art.
Of course. And,
Happy New Year.
Hope 23 is amazing.
It's going to be the year of fun, I've decided. We all have to have way more fun in 2023.
Great.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.